noise, and I don't think I could hear for about 5 minutes after. But we also suffer the side effect of lightning is that power goes out, and I don't have a big UPS to run transmitters in the place with yet, although that's going to happen. But in the meantime, we take a power dump, we go off the air for... Well, the digital transmitter comes right back on as soon as the power comes back, but the analog transmitter is... There's timers in that tube. You don't want to turn the high voltage on in that tube to let film that's good and hot, and the beam's all ready to go. K2RW, K3J.
So, you're saying you were in the transmitter room and everything turned white, and you couldn't hear? My guess is you saw a flash across your eye, even when you closed your eyes, and... I guess your hearing was disturbed. Sounds like you got a really nice lightning bolt there. I had a lightning bolt strike my tower directly about 4 years ago, and the biggest damage that occurred was that all of the transmitter and receiving circuits that were on the Cat5 cabling that went from the house out to my little shed alongside of my tower, and the computers connected to it, all became heavily damaged. I've now flipped over to fiber optics and all of that communication link, and have had no further damage since. So one beautiful way to avoid the EMP problem of wiring picking up ridiculously high voltage is to use fiber optics. And my guess is you've considered doing that in some of your data runs. When you get a power outage, Eric, my guess is you've got a standby zillion kilowatt diesel-powered generator that can bring you back on the air. Is that approximately true? KE2EJ, K2LIW?
No, both at Empire and at 21. Currently, no, actually. You lose power at Empire. It's about everybody goes dark, except for NBC and PIX. They have generators just up there on the 79th floor, actually. I think I told you the story about, when the World Trade Center went down and they put transmitters in there, and they had a lot of power issues, and they have to bring those drums of diesel fuel up the elevator. That has its own generator, by the way. But no, actually, come maybe before the winter, there might be a 750,000 kilowatt generator there. Which will handle everything, because as you are aware, we're building a disaster recovery site out there, which handles what's going on in New York, because no longer is it just 13, there's 9 streams, and 2 of them are nationally bad, so they can't afford to have it go down. One of the worst problems that PBS has, when we talk about weather, is they have redundant uplink sites that are 150 miles away from each other. But the funny thing is that a lot of times when the rain's bad, it's whacking out both of those uplink stations. So sometimes the network suffers a little bit. K2RW, KE2J.
Are we allowed to know where those uplink sites are located? What town or state?
Let's see. One is close to Arlington in Virginia. And I think the other one is... about 150 miles south and 70 miles west. I don't remember what town it's in.
Understand, so that's the main PBS uplink for the whole PBS network, if I think I understand you correctly. Then the downlink of that satellite goes to all of the ground stations at each of the individual local distribution centers. Is that approximately it, Eric?
Yeah, well, you can think of each local PBS station as a subscriber. The services is actually, it's going to change too, because we're starting to move pictures via data, and there's a new system which uses KA, which is like, forget about it when it rains, but it sends data into a server, and it winds up being pictures in a server, but it comes across as data. They also use the internet as a way of FEC around the ARQ, so that if it happens to have a little bit of brain outage where it's coming down, it'll, through the regular internet, we'll go back to Washington and say, hey, I need just these sectors of this material, and it'll resend it. And if the satellite path is busy doing something else, it'll bring it back slowly over the internet. So there's some redundancy there. But each station is nice and subscriber to the network, so they're basically downlink the sites. But we currently feed the national feed. We create a service called Create and another service called World in conjunction with GBH. We currently feed it fiber from New York to Washington, and then that's how it gets up on the PBS satellite. There's like 16 channels of stuff going on this satellite continuously. KQRWK, two joints.
Wow. And it's a 4 megabyte wide encryption. It's a six megacycle wide channel. And it's encrypted material, so the actual number of megabits per second is a much bigger number yet. I think you have the ability to send the data, not necessarily live, but ahead of time. In other words, in theory, by way of your satellite link or your ground fiber link, you can send the data a week ahead of time, record it locally, confirm that it's in good shape and it's on two different hard drives, and then when the appropriate hour actually play them. So my guess is some of the data is sent ahead of time, and therefore you've got a kind of a buffer when it comes to a storm. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
Okay. Actually, we call it the NGIS, so the Next Generation Interface System. The way things work, generally programs come 4 days ahead of time, and they get loaded up. Depends what it is, but that's the going thing. But things like the NewsHour, Charlie Rose, those types of events, they're either live or almost live. NewsHour is live, so, you know, there's no way you're sending that ahead of time. But Charlie Rose is, they get that about 7:30, 8 o'clock, because they do it in the evening after he's done a whole lot of other stuff. Although they actually shoot in the afternoon, but the show has to be put together and prepared. So, it arrives via horse and buggy over at 13 from Bloomberg Studio. It's about, 8:30, 9 o'clock. And then they play it out to the network, and the first feed, goes out at 9:30 or 10:30. I forget. I think 10:30. And then another one at 11, and then another one at 12. So, but that becomes tape playback at that point.
Fascinating. Most amateurs have a sub-interest of radio and television broadcast. And let's face it, when we're sitting in front of a microphone, and some of us get into fast-scan television, we really want to be broadcasters to some degree. Narrowcasters, broadcasters, you know what I mean. So Mel and I get a lot of favorable email when you give us information about what it's like in the broadcast industry. But I'll bet you've seen some awful big lightning bolts not very far from your house, since you're not very far from a body of water, Manhattan Beach. I wonder, is that true, Mel? K2KEY, K2, now here we go. Yeah, I got it right. K2KEY, K2RIW on the tech map.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. This time wasn't too bad around. We did see here some activity, heavy activity further out into the towards the ocean, towards the Rockaways, which is across the waterway from where I am. But in the past, we've had a couple of real bad ones here. As far as being, you know, electrocuted people, we've had a number of cases here on the beaches. And now they just close the beach. They don't let you onto the beach anymore. Anytime or there's a storm coming up, they get warnings and everybody off the beach. There was one young fellow, teenager that was electrocuted on the bicycle path here. There's a bicycle path that runs adjacent to the Belt Parkway that, you know, follows along the water's edge, basically. And he got lightning, hit him right on top of the head. And they said it was unbelievable what it did to him. It was actually almost impossible to identify him. And that was on a bicycle, so I guess the, thought that maybe the rubber wheels would help you survive such a thing you know, like people think in a car, but it's not the rubber wheels in a car, it's the metal body of the car that creates the situation of lightning going around it. I guess similar to an airplane, am I correct? Over.
I think you're absolutely right. It's the metal cage, the Faraday shield around your body that the car provides. That's where the real protection is. It wouldn't matter if your rubber tires were made out of steel and the current hitting the car flowed down from the steel tires instead of jumping the gap across the rubber tires and jumping the ground. Wouldn't matter. Your protection inside of the car would be approximately the same. You got it exactly right. And the same case in an airplane. You're reasonably safe in an airplane because you have this metal cage around you. Now, how well is that metal cage bonded? The individual sheets of metal in that airplane, how well are they riveted together to the frame? Minor thing to worry about. A more major thing to worry about is there's an awful lot of electronics on an airplane these days, and a direct lightning strike to the airplane, although they've added a lot of protection, nothing is perfect. You could lose navigation, communication. You could lose some vital things. And as time goes on and airplanes become more and more fly-by-wire, as they call it. In other words, in the old days, you move the control stick and there are aircraft cables that are being moved across pulleys, which eventually end up at a belt crank, which moves a control surface on the airplane. And maybe there's a power assist, but at least there's a manual override and you're physically moving the control surface in the airplane when you move that control stick. As aircraft get larger and larger and more automatic in their control, all of a sudden the control stick now is issuing an electronic command through a wire, and that wire, by way of a servo motor that's located in the vicinity of the control surface, now you're giving a command to a motor that moves, and all of a sudden that system is a lot more vulnerable to an electric disturbance, as you can see. So you talk to pilots, and they're very leery of fly-by-wire aircraft, unless the system has got all kinds of backup protection systems. Back to you, Mel, K2RIW.
Chuck, this is K2KEY. I understand the aircraft, modern aircraft. They have taken tremendous amounts of precautions to protect now the delicate electronics, and most of the planes, they said, now have flown through lightning storms without any problem. At least it's not unusual anymore for a plane to get hit by lightning. As far as myself, a few years ago, now this is going back a good number of years, we once had a storm here, a real doozy, coming off the ocean. And it struck top of the tower here three times. And up the tower started to sound like it was being rung by a bell. But I think what saved everything, basically, is that that 5 foot mask that I have that goes on top of the upper, both the top of the top of that 5 foot mask has a porcupine on top of it. The tower has very good grounding systems. I got a rod right underneath the tower that is welded right through the tower base that goes down about 12 feet. And then there's the grid of grounds that I got around it that are all bonded together with night number. I think it was like number 4 wire or so, braised to each one of those ground rods, those 8-foot or 9-foot ground rods that are driven into the soil here. But I think that desensitizing idea with that porcupine on there is very important, because I see around a number of buildings, they got these sharpened spikes that are grounded, Dick, over.
Yep, I agree with him. The metallic whisk broom, so to speak, upside down, mounted on the top of the tower, I think can do a very good job of a local discharge of lightning. I've been on top of my tower during a voltage buildup once, and I saw the tips of my 432 Yagi all lighting up with a purple glow, and I was hearing a buzzing sound. I didn't dwell there very long. I knew that something nasty was about to happen. This was a snowstorm in February, and it's hard to believe that you can get a voltage buildup in the wintertime. It's not as likely to happen in this neighborhood, but I've been in Montreal, Canada, and listening to thunder and lightning during a thunderstorm in February during a snowstorm in Canada. Strange sound. I remember being in a taxi cab and hearing the thunder, and the snow is coming down, and I said, "What is that?" He says, "It's thunder and lightning." I said, "I've never heard that in the wintertime." He says, "We get it here all the time." So, I used to get a lot of radio noise on my 432 receiver when the 432 antenna used to be the top thing on the tower. When I rearranged things so that there was another 5 or 8 feet of mast sticking out of the top of the tower above the highest antenna, then a tremendous amount of that radio noise essentially disappeared. Instead of that arcing and sparking taking place on the tips of my 432 Yagi, it was now taking place on that mast, I think. And so it made life a lot easier. I think we ought to pick up Paul before he has to go to sleep tonight and tell us what's going on in space. WS2N, I hope you're available. And where were you during that thunderstorm, Paul? K2RAW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. Well, Mark Hockman, and, you know, we saw lightning and thunder, but nothing really to write home about. Farmingdale looked like it had a funnel cloud. They had on Channel 12 News, someone took a picture from the road right near Republic Airport. So yeah, I don't know if it touched down or anything, but somebody took a picture. I saw that. It's an interesting, interesting day. I think tomorrow, too, is supposed to be a weather problem. Well, it's hot and humid here. I was thinking about Mars before, you know, for the net. And the temperatures there, you can check every day on the net when you go to the Arizona website that's handling the Phoenix mission. You know, they have warm temperatures of like minus 28 degrees. And the lows are minus 180 or something of that nature, Fahrenheit. And but I mean, you know, the mission is still going on. They're up to Sol number 61. Let me drop it. Sol number 61. Sol is at the Martian day. A little bit longer than an Earth day. I think it's roughly, 40 minutes or something longer per day. And thirds of the mission are officially over, because they planned on a 3-month mission. Now you're up to 2 months. Looks like only now they're finally getting debris into the Tiger, into the oven experiment. This thing landed on Mars, back in May. And dug trenches. But they've had trouble getting material into the oven to heat it. Last attempt, they show pictures. They took a picture of the oven, the open oven, and the soup. Some of the pieces were too big to get in, and very, very small fractional pieces got in into the oven. It's not enough for an experiment for them to close the doors and heat it up to 1,000 degrees and see what it consists of. So they're going to go back, put the scoop back on the ground, and drill into the ground. The drilling process is making the material sticky. It's actually heating it up and then sticking to the scoop and sticking everywhere. So this time they're going to cut back on the drilling time. Let me drop it. And they're also going to increase the amount of time that they bring the scoop over the oven and try to get this very small amount of material into the oven. This part, you know, they change the program. Instead of shaking or vibrating the scoop a certain amount of number of times per second, they're going to increase that amount of times per second to try to, you know, vibrate this material vigorously into off the scoop and into the small oven. It's very, very small ovens, by the way, when I'm talking about something to put Hansel and Gretel in. These are 8 very small, I guess, a couple of cubic centimeters each, you know, maybe a square inch or something. Very, very small. One time use only. They have 8 of them on board. So we're looking forward to the successful completion of that, and then, of course, the results, which I guess will take some time to analyze, Dick. One other comment I wanted to make. Last week, let me drop it. Last week was the 20th, so that was the 39th anniversary of the landing of Apollo 11 on the moon. And I just wanted to mention that because we have one more year to go, and we'll be up to 40th year, and still officially not brought people back since Apollo 17, which had Eugene Cernan and Schmidt on that mission. So, interesting times ahead. I think we're still quite a few years from that. Probably at least 2013 or 14, maybe, before they have a manned mission anywhere. And of course, the first manned mission on the new Orion system will be to the International Space Station next up. Let's see. I hope I gave you enough time to look up that information for the other fellow too. But I really, like I said at the beginning, really don't have that all that much. I just wanted to mention how the Phoenix mission was going, and of course the anniversary of the Apollo moon landing, which just went by. And hello to you there, Mel. I cannot stay up lately for the 80-meter net. One of these days I got to do it. Either Monday or Wednesday or Friday, Mel. I keep doing it. Either fall asleep too early, then wake up later and realize it's past the time, but we'll try it again one of these days now. Let me drop it a second. I'm also having a little trouble with my Kenwood 440. I've got to run some experiments for about 20 meters. Interesting problem when you push the button it's got an internal antenna tuner. Push the button and the whole display, everything goes out. It's just like the power is temporarily failing. So I don't know if I'm getting RF into my power, maybe my power supply. Got an external power supply. Maybe getting to that. I'm going to bring a battery in, and then plug it into a battery system and try it again and see if that happens. But I'd say about 50% of the time's down. Got a problem with that lately. 80 meters is good. So if I'm up, Mel, tomorrow night, I'll get on 80. That's pretty much it for now, Dick. Back to Ned WS Swing.
Very fine. I didn't study as much of what you just said because I was going through this conversion process for Joe, which is about twice as elaborate as I expected it to be. Thank you for all the information. And the Apollo mission, boy, on a quick break, Paul, where were you at the instant that Neil Armstrong was stepping on the moon and saying those famous words, one giant leap for, one small step for, it should have been a man, one giant leap for mankind. Where were you? Were you still crawling on the floor at that time, Paul? Go ahead.
No, 17 years old, of course, living with the parents in Queens, in New Hyde Park, right across the street from LIJ. Those houses are still there. And there was a landing, and then, initial landing, the initial plan was to wait 24 hours. Neil Armstrong and Aldrin looked at each other and so excited. They weren't about to wait this 24 hours, so what it was, I think 6 hours later after landing, they opened the square hatch to get out of that limb. By the way, you ever notice it's a square hatch, not a round hatch, Dick? People don't realize what they went through over there. Grumman. Originally, it was supposed to be a round hatch, but they realized a square backpack on the back of the suit, they couldn't get out. That's why that's a square hatch when they go out on that little porch and down on the ladder. The original plans was not to have a ladder, imagine that. But pulled themselves down on a rope, but they did okay. They just kind of pulled themselves back up with all the space suits and the gear and God knows what else. So that's why they have a ladder. Back to you, Dick. WS Swing.
Okay. Joe's around. I've got an answer for him. But let me ask Mel. Mel, what were you doing at the instant? By the way, Paul, I'm pretty sure your nose was glued to a a television set at that time, and the whole family was gathered watching this event. Is that true?
But of course, on a black and white set, of course. what size TV was that? Well, you know what it is. I guess 12-inch, was that a number? Popular number? But the cabinets were like furniture. Wow. Back to you, Dick.
Understand. Mel, where were you at the instant that Neil Armstrong was doing his thing? Were you in the family house? I'm saying probably not. Let me think now. You were probably out of college and about to get married. I'm just making some pure guesses. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. What year was it exactly, Dick?
1969. June, I think it's June 27th. Or was it July? Hey, I used to know. Paul, you're going to have us bring us the old guys up to speed. What was the date that Neil Armstrong landed and said those words? You got it, Paul.
Yeah, well, the launch was on the 16th of July of 69. And 4 days later, they landed. So on the 20th, Dick, and then 6 hours after landing, they opened the open hatch. So that all, you know, the landing and the walking on the moon all occurred on the same day. And, and then, of course, it was only one EVA, I think about 4 or 5 hours, maybe a little less. About 4 hours, and that was it. The subsequent missions, of course, lasted longer, and they stayed overnight and went out again. But that's the number one the 20th of July 69.
I also remember that it was during prime time in the eastern part of the United States. It seemed like about 8 o'clock at night is when he stepped onto the moon, New York time. Is that approximately right, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, it was night, Eastern Standard Time, probably about, I think you're right. I know it was getting pretty late waiting to watch these guys walk around on the moon, you know. And that was about 6 hours later, so 8. No, it could have been into the next day, though. Probably a little earlier than 8 o'clock, because it wouldn't fall over until the 21st. Maybe 7 o'clock, 6 o'clock, something like that. I'd have to check. That's a good trivia question.
Well, Mel's going to tell us that. So Mel wasn't sure of the year. We now know it's July 20, 1969. And I think he stepped onto the moon in the vicinity of 8 p.m., 9 p.m. New York time. So you were probably glued to the family television set at that time. Is that true, Mel? K2KEY, K2LAW?
You're right. Yes, this is K2KEY now. I recall, yes, it was at night because I was home from work. I was working that time with Zena. And I remember we had one of the first Zena color TVs that I had gotten from them. And it was an old, with a 21-inch with a round, one of the old round picture tubes. And I remember watching it on that. We had it down the basement, a big clunker, big box, and constantly needed adjustment, but that's beside the point. And I remember it being at night, yes, around 8 o'clock at night or so. That I recall quite well. So I think most everybody was home at that time and really, I guess, watched it on their own TV set with the family, Dick, over.
Hey, now, Paul, I'm going to really push your trivia question answering ability. It is my guess that that was a weekday, like a Wednesday or a Thursday. I'm going to say it was a Thursday. I'm going to guess it was a Thursday because I know that my company closed down the next day because they knew that everybody's going to be waiting around, waiting for the blast off from the moon to make sure that they left safely. So the company was closed the very next day. Was it possibly on a Thursday night that Neil Armstrong stepped onto the moon? Back to you, Paul.
I don't know. It's possible. I really don't know, Dick. That's a good one. Of course, it was summertime, so I can't relate to that. You know, I didn't have school. Didn't have work, of course. I got a part-time job. I should be able to go by that. We'll have to check this one and look it up in a book or look it up on the internet. But during the middle of the week, yeah, it sounds possible. Probably. Probably take about 2 seconds to put this into Google. Faster than I could get it out of one of my books. Excuse me.
Sunday night, so.
It looks like we just found out it was a Sunday night, and therefore, next Monday morning, work was canceled. Maybe that's what it was. Okay, when it comes to Joe's question, Joe, are you on frequency?
Yes, I am, sir. Go ahead.
Okay, I got basically good news for you. I only worked out the first one. 32 ounces, a pair of 16 ounces, no, was it a pair of, yeah, 32 ounces of water. First thing I had to do is to convert ounces of water, liquid water, into cubic centimeters. 32 ounces of water, I came to the conclusion, is 946 cubic centimeters. Because I live in the world of calories and cubic centimeters, they relate. And then you had a 20-degree rise, but you have to convert 20 degrees Fahrenheit rise into 20 degrees, the equivalent in centigrade rise. So that's a 5/9 relationship. That's one of the conversions you got to do. After that, you got to recognize the fact that you did that 20 degrees rise, 946 cubic centimeters. When you convert that into calories, I believe it turned out to be 10,000 joules and 44,000 calories. Anyhow, no, 44,000 joules, there it is. 10,000 calories, 44,000 joules. The 44,000 joules is the amount of energy you put into that water in a 60-second period. You have to divide that by 60 seconds. When you do that, the answer came out 733 watts. So, a very rough calculation. Your water, at 32 ounces of water, absorbed 733 watts average during that 60 seconds. If I look at the, don't even bother separating how much current went into the magnetron, just look at the total current that went into your microwave oven, 10 amperes at 120 volts. You put 1200 watts in, you got 733 watts out. Total conversion from the plug in the wall to the heat of the water. That's 61% efficiency. Not bad. So, my rough calculation, 733 watts. And you see a little bit of the process. I had to convert ounces of water into cubic centimeters. I had to figure out 20 degrees rise, but make that into centigrade, because one calorie is 1 degree centigrade rise of 1 gram of water, 1 cubic centimeter of water. Then you have to convert that into joules. Joules equals watt seconds. Figure out how many seconds it ran, 60 seconds. I think you see the process. And so I wonder if you're kind of pleased with that result. The V2RYY, the guy with the high-power microwave oven, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Well, thank you, Dick, for converting that to an answer that's more easily to understand. 733 watts is fine by me. Not bad for 1990 microwave oven. Check this every day.
Now, there's a slim chance I've made a math error here, but that's what it seems to be saying. And when I get a chance, I'll later on tonight run that by again. So it sounds to me like your microwave oven's working like a charm. You probably came to the conclusion that, hey, it is X number of years old, it's getting old, and it should be low in efficiency. Well, magnetrons sometimes really keep their efficiency. Once you understand how a magnetron works, it's a really magic piece of hardware invented essentially during World War II in order to run X-band radars. The Raytheon Company, Sylvania Company, the Brits, they all were heavily involved. I think even Sperry had some of the action. All kinds of companies were building magnetron tubes. When you take a look at the latest issue of Microwave Journal, it's their 50th anniversary issue. They have reproduced many of the pages of the really significant microwave companies that existed 50 years ago, which I think is 1957. Yep, 1957, at this time of year. So they showed you what was Hewlett-Packard like, what was Raytheon like, what was Sylvania like, what was General Electric like, and so on. And so you'll discover that during the war, I think it was either Sperry or Raytheon, eventually got their production up to something like 1,000 microwave tubes per day. And how does it do that? Because the very early ones, let me drop. The very early magnetrons were, they started off with a great big chunk of copper and did a precision machining in order to make that star-shaped object that's the actual internal resonator. And it took a lot of work. They eventually found ways of making them out of thin sheets that were stamped. And then the thin sheets of stamped were welded together. A much faster process. So, as long as you've still got a filament left, and as long as you've still got a vacuum left in that tube, it's an amazingly simple device. Schematically, a magnetron tube is nothing but a diode. But that diode has got a strong magnetic field on the electrons that are the emitted by that cathode in the center. Therefore, they take a curved path going from the cathode in the center to the anode, which is around the perimeter. The anode has got a whole bunch of these little holes in that star-shaped pattern. And all of those individual holes are the resonators. And one of those resonators has an output coupling loop that couples the power out of it. So as long as you still got a vacuum and a cathode, and it draws the right amount of current, it's going to run at very close to the same efficiency. A tube, the only real wear-out mechanism is something goes wrong where you lose the vacuum, and that can happen because you made the mistake of running the microwave oven with no proper load on it, like putting a very dry piece of bread without a glass of water, and so that now all the microwave is generating bounce around that cavity and eventually go back to the tube. That's the only thing that can absorb it. And then that's it. You're asking the tube to dissipate all the power it's generating, and that's going to overheat the cathode. So that can artificially age your cathode. So the end of life is when all of those exotic materials that are in that cathode material boil to the surface and they're gone, and now you've got nothing left but a raw cathode, and unless you put it up to a very high temperature, it's not going to give you enough emission. As long as the tube's got emission and hasn't lost its vacuum, it's going to run darn close to the same efficiency. That's what you're confirming. So as long as that power supply hangs in there, that microwave oven might run for you for another 10 years. My particular microwave oven, I think, is more than 20 years old. Back to you, Joe, K2LIW.
Okay, very good. Well, I keep all my important appliances on surgery, very good surgery rest, because all it takes is one shot, even though the surgery rest is not a guaranteed cure-all. All it takes is one shot, you could lose the whole thing. So it's a very good operating appliance for having it for like 18-some-odd years. Do the filaments in these tubes run all the time, or they just command it up when you actually go to use it?
Repeat that last question, because a word dropped out. Go ahead.
Do the filaments in these tubes, in the microwave ovens, the magnetrons, run all the time, or is the filament commanded up when it's being used only?
Don, good question. Yeah, when you're running other than high power, the tube, by the way, doesn't have a low power mode. When you ask for a medium and low power mode, you're just changing the duty cycle at which you put voltage onto the tube. And what you're really asking me is, in between those duty cycles, does the filament run continuously? That may be a brand name specific phenomenon. Because the thermal cycling of the filament is one of the failure modes, if I was designing the tube that's going to be used in the medium and low power mode, I would run the filament continuously and just pulse on and off the B+. But I'm not sure. But I'm amazed that the magnetrons that I've used in the past, some of them have been as much as 1970, I was using a Ku-band radar, a MANPAC radar that was designed for Vietnam service. I think it was built roughly 1970. And I was using that in a little bit less than the year 2000. I was using it 30 years later. And when that tube was brand new, it had the ability to put out 1,000-watt pulses at Ku-band frequencies. And it was still putting out 1,000-watt pulses when I measured it in the year 2000. They've got an amazing longevity, those tubes. Really rugged device, very simple. As I said, it's only a diode. It's a negative impedance diode by way of the very strong magnetic field that's in there. Because those electrons that come boiling off that cathode don't go straight to the anode. They curve in a peculiar path because of the right angle magnetic field. The magnetic field is directly parallel to that filament, or cathode, let's call it, that goes right down the center of the tube. The tube is built sort of like a pie plate,
and in the center of the tube, perpendicular to the pie plate, is the cathode material. And the perimeter of the pie plate, you could say, is the anode. And the anode runs at ground potential, and you put something like minus 5,000 volts on the cathode with filament. So, we got to research that one to find out. Now, here's a question for you guys. I finally got a question for the TechNet. Let me drop. And that is, I might, sometime in the near future, go over to a fiber optic cable TV system. Mel's going to be raising his eyebrows on this one. Because my internet connection is becoming a little bit flaky, and I'm eventually going to have to upgrade it, I may go over to Fios fiber optics. It is my guess that what Fios does is brings the fiber to the house. I am guessing that there's a little doghouse, a little enclosure on the outside of the house where the fiber ends, and it goes into some kind of a converting device that then feeds something like a Cat5 cable, is my guess. And then the Cat5 cable, in my case, where I'm feeding a bunch of computers in the house, is going to go to a router. So, am I correct in assuming the fiber comes to the house, gets converted between fiber signal and a real voltage signal that goes on a Category 5 cable, an 8-conductor Category 5 cable, which then goes to the router, which goes to the computers in the house? Am I even close to the way that kind of a system is typically wired? Anybody's got any knowledge on this? Give me a call that is right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2J.
Go ahead, Eric.
Now, see if there's anybody else out there with fire.
I don't have fires, but a friend of mine does, and I've seen the box that attaches on the side of his house. He should have asked to put it inside. It's a little large. It's about almost the size of a like local power meter type of thing. It doesn't stick out as far, but it's like say like the meter pan or somebody. It's something a little bigger than that as far as size wise. But they do nail it to the outside of the house, and they put a pre-made piece of fiber from there to the pole, and then they bring the connections in. You have to supply power backup to this unit if you want to keep the batteries charging if you lose your AC, because they have internal batteries, but they only give you like between 4 to 8 hours of time before it drops. Another thing, as far as TV goes, they only give you a handful of channels, maybe up to 25 channels that you'll actually get out of the unit itself without having it converted. If you want to get their package that has all the digital channels and so forth, they're not converted all into analog to go right into your TV set. You need a converter box for each television set.
KC2QIQ.
Thank you very much, Joe. Glenn, go ahead.
Yes, Dick, I do have Fios in the house, and the way the system works is from the street. It's basically the fiber optic cable is fed into the house. The modem is actually located on the outside or the exterior on a relatively large box where they basically splice the end of the fiber optic cable into the modem box, and then the modem box then separates three separate outputs. One output is basically for the router. One section goes to the router, and then the router basically feeds the internet through the Cat5 connection from there. Then there's the connection for the television, which is the digital coaxial connection, and of course the other output is the phone connection. But the connection from the modem, which is on the outside of the house, to the router is a coaxial connection.
I'll take it here, Dick.
Okay, thank you for that one, Glenn. Glenn, the modem that's outside the house, I have to supply it power. Is that 110 volt power, or is that fed with a wall wart and something like 12 volts? Back to you, Glenn.
They supply a wall wart and a battery. So the battery has to basically is charged from the wall wart, which is also supplying the power, and it gives you approximately between 6 and 12 hours of backup time.
Okay, I'm a lot smarter. I think you said you wanted to add to that, Eric, KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Yeah, what they do is the fiber that goes into this box that they have, they mount it on the outside of the house, and yeah, you have to provide power for it. It's WDM. It's, you know, it's wave division multiplex, where they actually use different color lights, as opposed to cable, which has certain frequencies which are allocated for, like, the cable modems. Actually, they can only put maybe a cluster of 1,000 homes on one local set of nodes, so, interestingly enough, the cable systems use the same frequencies for all that stuff, and it's shared in the cable, RF-wise. But the nice thing about Fios is they use different wavelengths of light for different services, and they have oodles and oodles of spectrum, and to get to the TV set, of course, it has a up-converter, a modulator in there. Essentially, it's taken out at light frequencies, it's modulated at the channel spacing, but for the HD services and their video on demand, the VOD services, those are actual single channels that wind up back in the head end. They have a rather interesting way of doing things, whereas the AT&T's method of fiber really is fiber to the street, and it's RF all from that point. So the Fios method actually is a little more robust, has considerably oodles more bandwidth than all those other systems out there, and the modes of failure are interesting because there are less of them.
I wonder if there's a kind of redundancy. In other words, they won't bring just one single fiber into my house. I presume it's a dual pair. In other words, I'm going to get an orange lead with two fibers in it, so it looks like the fiber equivalent of twin lead. Back to you, Eric.
No, negative, Dick. It's not like dual mode fiber. It's a single fiber, but there'll be a whole bunch of stuff, maybe a gigahertz worth of bandwidth at 640 nanometers. And then there'll be another gigabit's worth of bandwidth at 680 nanometers. And then there'll be another whole gigabit worth of space at 710 nanometers. Get the point?
Yes, I did get that point earlier. But to have one single piece of fiber go from the street to my house, which can be flexed in the wind and ice and ultraviolet exposure and whatever, since one of the popular kinds of fiber cable is this orange-looking thing that I've seen, which has got two fibers side by side. So it looks like zip cord. So there's a kind of redundancy in the system. Do they bring in really one single piece of fiber with an armored cable around it? Or would you bring in two separate fibers just to be double sure? Thank you, Eric.
Okay, now I understand what you're talking about. Well, you're really talking about a match cord, so short fiber length runs. It's usually orange cable. A lot of it's dual mode and quad mode fiber, meaning that it's multi-directional, which you can do on a single fiber, but it's just the way that they handle the bandwidth. It's really a legacy kind of thing. You will see anything that runs a gigabit or higher in the commercial world using those with really interesting looking connectors. But you really have to then look at the way the services are run and the way fibers are bundled together, because that individual fiber that leaves your house winds up back at the central switching office. It's not like it's melted into a bunch of other fibers. That single strand will go however many miles it needs to go to get back to the central point of origin. And they have these interesting repeating devices, which essentially they do light amplification just by simply injecting more light into it. If you ever take their trip up to Corning Glass, they have a whole session in there where they make the fibers and they show you fiber light amplifiers and all sorts of neat things that you can have a look at. I'm going to drop to that. The fiber is an interesting field. It's just very simplistic at one point of view, but to look at the way they do light switching and the way they terminate between fibers. Just making the fiber splice is an interesting. It's gotten so much better over the years. The devices that we use to make the splices have improved dramatically, and also that has a lot to do with the way the fibers themselves are drawn, but it's a whole world unto itself, but it's the same laws of physics that we follow from DC all the way on up.
Huge reason.
Bill Ricker, recognized. Hey, Bill, tell us your experience with fiber. The A2QGZ K2LIW in the second half.
A2QGZ KTLIW. Yeah, I kind of think files works good for me, pretty reliable. The service drops, though, are, it's an armored fiber. It's in a outer jacket that's approximately a half inch by maybe a quarter inch thick. So it's pretty robust. And the way the service drops are done, they're pre-made lengths. And when the guy comes around to do your install, he picks the length that's closest to you. And then, you know, rigs it in such a way that he might have a loop up on the pole or whatever. But there's, you know, there's no splicing, no connectors really in the field. And if your service drop fails for any reason, you'll just get a whole new drop from the pole down into the house. Okay.
Interesting. Now, Eric, you said that for legacy reasons, they tend to run two fibers where one going in each individual direction, yet they could go bi-directionally on one particular fiber if they wanted to. Also, I think you said one particular fiber might feed, I'm going to pick a number, 15 houses. So by some means, there's a 15-to-1 power divider going to the 15 houses. Then that one piece of fiber from those 15 houses winds its way all the way back to the central station, the central office, if I understand you correctly. Maybe I got some of that a little bit mixed up. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
KE2QIQ.
Glenn recognized, but Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I think you've mixed up the point of what I was talking about. Whereas cable has to have X number of nodes, X number of subscribers on a node, because they occupy the same piece of bandwidth on the cable itself. What they do is they make these local nodes, and then via either OC3 or some other form of that way of getting it back to their central place, they connect these nodes back to the cable head end. So a node of like 1,000 houses, I wasn't talking about that in terms of fiber. But what I was saying is that AT&T does sort of like a cable system with fiber and branch off via coax to everyone else. So the BIOS method of doing things brings the individual strand to fiber.
Okay, I think you're saying now, if I made myself micro-miniature and I became a light wave, and I walk down the fiber that goes to the box on the outside of my house, I could walk down that fiber and walk all the way back to the central office. And are you telling me that if Fios has 10,000 subscribers in my community, that the central office has 10,000 pieces of fiber coming into that central office? Something doesn't sound quite right there. Back to you, Eric.
Yeah, what my understanding is, and we've dealt with them a lot, not from the subscriber end, but from the provider end. Yes, but, you know, think about it. The fiber is one heck of a lot thinner than the copper that they use for the 10,000 landline telephone subscribers, times two.
Okay, we're slowly getting smarter. Hey, Glenn, tell us how this system probably works. Mr. QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, just a quick comment about the wire that comes into the house. It's the actual piece of fiber is just a little bit thicker than a hair. It's extremely thin. And it has a very, very delicate end that has to be specially spliced with a special tool set in order to get it to meet the end that goes into the modem on the house. The other side of the connection could run a couple of poles down, you know, to wherever I guess the local junction box is. And inside that junction box is basically like a trunking of all of these individual strands that are running off into the local houses, of which at that point, this junction box is, I guess, both an amplifier and a mirroring device that's summed into a larger cable. So in other words, these very, very thin cables are going into a trunked, even larger piece of fiber optic cable. And that's the one that gets trunked down the street back to the local distributor, that was their main controlling station. But like Eric is saying, the light individually isn't broken up into separate channels. It's really just one very, very large channel of light that's going into even a larger piece of fiber optic cable going back to the main station.
KB2YTT.
KB2YTT recognized. Get to you in a second. Why isn't some multiplexing taking place here? When that fiber at the central office is sending all those channels of information out to subscribers. Why can't multiple homes get that information in parallel? Why does it have to be a individual fiber to each individual house? Back to you on that one, Eric.
The whole concept of Fios, guys, when they were thinking about it, was how do we provide a VOD service system in high definition, and how do we deal with controlling our content, okay? Ultimately, right, that strand of fiber goes to a piece of subscriber equipment, which is dedicated to feeding your box. That box that you're using to watch your HD movie or whatever it is, your pay-per-view, is feeding just a single full bandwidth signal down that particular color of this fiber to that box. It's not like the cable system where they're starving for bandwidth because they have so many channels that can only pass through, you know, 1,000 megahertz worth of cable. You avoid that problem by not sending the entire system down that piece of fiber. When you select the channel on your box, you're really back at the head end changing the router that it's connected to that's feeding that terminal. By the way, in terms of economics, it's a lot cheaper to have a very large cross point matrix to do that business. And for the regular service, which kind of had to be by law, so you could hook up sets without a converter box or cable box or whatever you want to call it, or a Fios box, it would provide the normal, you know, 2 through 13 complement of non-premium broadcast, which is done in the limited bandwidth way, all sent all at the same time. KTRIWK2, Jack.
Okay, it's beginning to make a little bit more sense. So, back to their router, their fiber signal router, back at their central office, literally sends me a block of channels, that's my general service, and then they apply the pay-per-view service. And I guess then, therefore, I've got the ability to start and stop the pay-per-view service when I desire it. That's my understanding. It gives them a lot more flexibility because they don't have to be sending signals down the system to enable it on house number 3 but disable it on house number 4 on the signal that's on a common piece of cable. So each individual house has its own piece of fiber. Wow. KB2YYT, I think it was. I may have your call letters wrong. Correct me on your call letters. Give me your name, and then proceed with your piece of information. I'm K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Yes, Dick, how you doing? It's Kilo Bravo 2, Yankee Tango Tango. And you're right. It's one fiber coming out of the central office. They hit a box called the hub. And what that hub does, it has cryptums in it, and it takes that one fiber and turns it into 32 ports. Now, from those 32 ports, they feed out to 32 different houses on a separate piece of fiber out of the hub to the home. But going back to the it's actually 32 customers sharing one piece of fiber, and the ONTs on the outside of the house are addressed in numbers and dependent, and they get programmed from the central office to whatever package you got. So you can't be swapping them around because everything's coded on the computer side, you know, on the outside of the house and at the CO. Back to you.
WH4YY.
KCQIQ.
Joe and Glenn recognize in that order. Hey, Bill, you've given us quite a bit more information. Also, you're in New Kingston, New York. I'm amazed how strong you are in the input. Are you at your home QTH or are you visiting a relative? Back to you, Bill.
No, I'm actually out in Ronkonkoma. I can't figure out how to change my email address up in New Kingston, but I still got the house up there. I work for the Verizon, and I've been on splicing the Fios for a little while there. So, they never, even being an employee, they never gave you quite an understanding. You just pick up bits and pieces from being out in the field. But most of the time, at these hubs, you might drop off half a ribbon fiber is like 12 fibers put together, like glued together. And usually what we did is we stripped them in half and diverted six fibers into the hub. And each one of those six went to feed a port that handled 32 customers. And the guys would come out and they put their jumpers, from the central office and pick up a separate fiber going straight up from the hub to the individual house, which you don't share with anyone. It's your individual, and they make that cross connection in the box. It's a pretty neat system, and like I said, they constantly upgrade the modems on the outside. I can't think of it, the concentrators, and they fit more and more information. So it uses the same fiber, but they just get faster and faster, so it's a constant upgrade on it. So they got the flexibility to do whatever they want, really. And what the other guy was saying with the AT&T is they end up out on down the block somewhere, and then they feed with coax, down maybe 20, 30 poles and feed the house, where Verizon actually, you are on fiber all the way back to the CO.
Lots of good information there, Bill. The box outside the house, you called it OMP. Sounds like you said Oscar Mike Papa. What does that stand for? Optical mode? Periphery or something like that? Go ahead.
Oscar November Tango. I think it's optical, I can't think of it. Network terminal or something like that. And they're right about the drop is just one single fiber, and it's very beefy, like a tree branch can fall on it, and you don't have to worry about it getting wrecked. But it is one fiber, that's all they send and receive on it.
Very interesting. Okay, we've got Joe and Glenn in that order. Joe, you've got it for V2LYY, KQLAW.
Hi. I've been listening to this for a while. I've been trying to find out, and I guess I don't know if I completely understand how this works, but you said one fiber up on a pole, well, it comes out to 32 ports, it basically feeds 32 houses. Is there some sort of electronics going on inside that box up on the pole? I have seen them, the large green boxes down here on Long Island. And if so, what is powering them besides commercial power? In other words, if you have a power failure, how long will that stuff out on the pole operate if it has electronics in it during a power failure?
Yeah, that question is for you, Bill, KQLIW.